David Weiss for the Daily Worker Placement, and you're listening to The Game Changers, Episode 10, Less is More, Part 2. In Part 1, we told the story of Seiji Kanai's 2012 game Love Letter, which put Japan on the map as a new hotspot for game design. The term microgame, which had actually been coined in the 1970s, as we'll discuss in a sec, was resuscitated to describe Love Letter, a game in a drawstring bag, later a small box, which used its 16 cards and handful of cubes to maximum effect. Love Letter was a game changer not only because it opened the door for other Japanese and Asian designers, but because its success woke designers and publishers up that there were plenty of players out there who were looking for games with interesting decisions and replayability that didn't weigh a ton or take up a whole table's worth of space. The fact that Love Letter did this using so few components prompted, one might even say dared, others to try their hands at creating their own microgames. Let's start, though, with the microgame genre itself, and trace its journey both backwards and forwards from Love Letter. Although I said in Part 1 that the term microgame had been coined to describe Love Letter, the word has been around since at least the 1970s. In fact, both SPI and Steve Jackson Games, whom we met back in Episodes 5 and 8 respectively, had used the term to market lines of games. Both companies recognized that there was a market for small, quick, and cheap games that could be used as gateways into a hobby that was known for, and in some respects handicapped by, a reputation for games with thick rule books and hours-long playing times. SPI produced a series of introductory war and science fiction-themed games that came in Ziploc bags and sold for under $10, such as Napoleon at Waterloo and The Creature That Ate Sheboygan. Steve Jackson Games released Car Wars and Ogre, among many others. After the arrival of Catan and the first wave of German or Euro games, there were plenty of what were called filler games to choose from, so called because they filled gaps in an evening of board games. Before everyone arrived, as a palate cleanser between more complicated games, or at the end of the evening as players wound down. The term is at least as old as Board Game Geek itself. The earliest reference I could find is from a session report for a game called What the Heck, from January 1st, 2001. Examples of classic filler games from the era are Wolfgang Kramer's 1994 game Six Nimmt, Stefan Dora's For Sale from 1997, and Thorsten Gimler's 2004 No Thanks. All three are still in print and hit the table or screen regularly among seasoned gamers. Some think of filler as a negative term, as in, oh, that's just a filler game. Others, like myself, see filler games as occupying a valuable niche in the tabletop ecosystem. Not every gamer wants to play only six-hour games about German politics. Sometimes you just want to play something less mentally demanding that allows for chit-chat and socializing while you play. Now, the line between filler and microgame is fuzzy, maybe arbitrary. I mean, Six Nimmt used a deck of 104 cards. No Thanks only had 33 cards and 55 tokens. And For Sale had 60 cards and 84 money tokens. All came in very small boxes and had just a couple of pages of rules. Some think the terms filler and microgame are synonymous. Others, like myself, believe that there is a qualitative as well as a quantitative difference between the two, although it might be hard to define. To me, the decisions you make in a filler are meant to be interesting and fun, but not brain-taxing, whereas the severity of a microgame tends to take one game mechanic and distill it to almost its platonic essence, so every choice feels consequential. In the wake of Love Letter, we saw pure bluffing games like Skull and Roses and Cockroach Poker, worker placement games like Province, push your luck games like Circus Flocati, tile-laying games like Sprawlopolis or Iota, and area control games like Coin Age, whose board was the size of a single regular size playing card. And we've already mentioned the micro-social deduction game Coup 2 episodes ago. Some companies, such as Paco Games and Button Shy Games, have gone all in on micro-games, realizing that small games equals low production costs. I mean, Paco Games literally packages its games in little boxes the size of a pack of gum. And Button Shy can even offer digital printed play versions of its games because people are willing to print out a few precious colored copies if it means it gives them a robust play experience. I did that with Button Shy's Sprawlopolis and have never regretted it. I carry Sprawlopolis around with me in my satchel in case I needed a diversion and there's no Wi-Fi. Meanwhile, other companies, such as Gamelin Games and AEG, have carved a related niche in the tabletop ecosystem for what I call TARDIS games, a reference to the TARDIS from Doctor Who. These are games that come in small boxes, but are much bigger on the inside. They're definitely more elaborate than microgames component-wise, but provide an astounding amount of tactical and strategic depth relative to their overall size and components. Perhaps the first TARDIS game was 2005's Glory to Rome by Ed Carter and Carl Chudik. At heart, the game was about resource management and tableau building as players raced to amass points by constructing point-generating buildings and collecting sets of luxury items. But each card in the game could be used in one of four mutually exclusive ways: as a resource, as an action, as a building with a special power, or as a luxury item. Add a role selection mechanic that had every player able to follow the active player's action on their turn, and you got a tremendously deep and varied game that attracted a cult following, and resulted in one of the more infamous Kickstarter campaigns when its 2012 reprint went horribly wrong. Nevertheless, Glory to Rome's use of multifunction cards pointed the way for several other designs to come, as we shall see. Meanwhile, Gamelin Games out of Queen Creek, Arizona, began a series of TARDIS games in 2014 with Tiny Epic Kingdoms, which is still going strong as of recording. Each game in the Tiny Epic series tackles a different genre or theme: space, westerns, zombies, pirates, and each uses a different combination of mechanics. They're not just cut-and-paste variations of each other. Gamelin has their development, fundraising, and production pipeline down to a science, with one game in the works, another on Kickstarter, and a third in production or on its way to backers and stores at any given time. Their high-quality components attract eyeballs at the gaming table, even if they're not as big as regular games. And they make sure to include multiple modes of play, including solitaire play, so that players feel like they're getting the most bang for their buck. Best games in the series, in my opinion, are the 4X space game Tiny Epic Galaxies and the Legend of Zelda-inspired Tiny Epic Quest. I don't back every single game, but I do check each one out as they emerge from the Gamelin pipeline. I'm currently waiting for the next game, Tiny Epic Pirates, which is going to use a rondel as its sort of driving mechanic. The lead designer for the Tiny Epic series, Scott Almaze, has also turned his hand to some other interesting little games, such as the unusual two-player trick-taking game Claim, the mathy puzzle race game Lovelace and Babbage, and the kid-friendly, but definitely not childish, drafting game Best Treehouse Ever. I'm very interested in his upcoming solo game, Warp's Edge, which is coming out from Renegade Games. Meanwhile, the next TARDIS game to leverage the use of multi-use cards was 2015's Oh My Goods by German designer Alexander Pfister. Each card in this card-only tableau-building game could be used as an input resource or a building, and, borrowing a concept from 2007's classic Race for the Galaxy, face-down cards on top of buildings represented production output, which could be chained from building to building to produce ever more valuable goods. This was combined with a push-your-luck mechanism in which players had to designate which buildings would produce before knowing exactly which basic resources would be available. The result was a game with tantalizing decisions throughout and huge replayability. Pfister even produced two sequels which added a campaign mode that was playable solitaire or cooperatively, a pioneering innovation he would explore further and which we will discuss in more depth in episode 13. Other TARDIS games were 2015's Guns and Steel and 2016's Flow of History, two civilization-themed games by Taiwanese designer Jesse Lee, which had players choosing whether to use cards for their resource value or their special powers. Lee is just one of a whole cohort of designers from East Asia who have risen to prominence, thanks, I believe, in part to Seiji Kanai's success. We'll take a look at some of their stories in a few minutes. First, though, let's look at Seiji Kanai's post-Love Letter career. Kanai's next new design, 2013's Lost Legacy, was, like Love Letter, a game with 16 ranked cards with a gameplay of draw one and play one, but instead of trying to be the last player standing, players were racing to deduce the location of the Lost Legacy card, which might be in someone's hand or hidden in the ruins in the middle of the table. The other twist of Lost Legacy is that the game was actually the first of a series. The base game contained two sets of 16 cards, each of which was playable separately, and at least 10 more themed standalone sequels have been released since. Cards of the same rank could be swapped in and out of each set, or you could shuffle two sets together to play with up to six players. I think of Lost Legacy almost as a microgame, non-collectible version of Magic the Gathering without the collectability, with themed sets coming out every year or so, providing an ever-changing meta. In 2014, AEG, the publishers of Love Letter, also released two of Kanai's games whose designs predated Love Letter, Say Bye to the Villains and My Star. Seibai, in Japanese, means growth or cultivation, so the name is a pun on the game's theme, which is one of preparation or training. Players work together to defeat a villain by uncovering hints about the villain's weaknesses and using that knowledge to buff a group of heroes to take the villain down. In My Star, players take the role of geishas competing to earn the most money by attracting rich and powerful guests, which requires increasing your popularity. Both My Star and Seibai were light card games with solid and very Japanese themes, but they weren't micro games. Yet, Kanai's continued success has been not as a world builder, but as a miniaturist, an artist who creates tiny, intricate paintings, carvings, or photographs, like Tatsuya Tanaka. He hasn't yet been able to design anything as popular or durable as Love Letter or Lost Legacy. Instead, he seems content to help to produce a slew of Love Letter versions attached to popular IPs, intellectual properties, such as Batman, Adventure Time, H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu Mythos, and even Santa Claus. The success of the Love Letter franchise may have acted as a dampener on Kanai's creativity. Only time will tell. AEG's success with Kanai probably encouraged them to buy and release several games by another Japanese designer, Hisashi Hayashi. Hayashi has proved very versatile, capable of designing microgames like the Mini Euro Sail to India and the trick-taking game Patronize, or innovative deck builders like Trains, which introduced a board and network building to the genre, as well as pioneering roll and write games, a genre which we'll be discussing more in episode 13, such as Rolling Japan. Hayashi's 2016 game Yokohama, which combined pick-up and deliver with Mancala-like worker placement mechanics, along with a modular setup for endless replayability, was perhaps his heaviest and most successful game to date, breaking into Board Game Geek's top 100, a feat which Kanai has failed to do, and it's made him the highest-ranked designer from Japan on Board Game Geek to this point. There's no question that many Japanese designs embody a kind of quirky humor. One of my favorites is 2014's Too Many Cinderellas, designed by Nobutake Dogen and Nao Shimamura. Using only 18 cards and a handful of tokens, Too Many Cinderellas was an unpredictable logic-based game in which players each vied to marry off their candidate to the handsome prince, even if that candidate turned out to be an old man, or even a cat. But despite coming to prominence because of microgames, not all Japanese designers were interested in them. You had the brain-burning, time-traveling logic game Tragedy Looper by a designer calling himself Bakafire. And then there was 2012's Machikoro by Masao Sugunuma, which was kind of a streamlined update of the basic gameplay loop of Catan. Roll dice, everyone generates resources, use resources to buy new things. And Machikoro has become a very popular gateway game with several expansions. The designer Kuro seems to specialize in games with anime or manga type themes with very original mechanics. His 2013 game, Ravens of Three Sahasri, was an asymmetric two-player-only cooperative game, with one player taking the role of a young woman in a coma, only able to communicate via dream message, and the other, a handsome young man trying to break her out of her mind prison. And in 2015, he released The Terrifying Girl Disorder, which took card drafting and set collection to an entirely new level, set in a future world where beautiful young girls called Blossoms were being hunted down for their supernatural powers. Of course. And in recent years, a Japanese publishing company called Oink Games has made a niche for itself with games in extremely small boxes and limited components that definitely straddle the line between filler and microgame. Starting with 2011's In a Grove, followed by 2012's party bluffing game A Fake Artist Goes to New York, and 2014's Push Your Luck Deep Sea Adventure, all were designed or co-designed by Oink's CEO Jun Sasaki. Sasaki's games, with their distinctive game and graphic design sense, have established him as another Japanese designer to watch. But Japan was, of course, not the only Far East country with tabletop fans and designers. Very quickly, other centers emerged in places like Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, and China. I've already mentioned Taiwanese designer Jesse Lee. And then you have Koreans Young Ming Jung and Jun Hyuk Kim, who, among other games, have produced the innovative Patch History, sort of an abstract card-laying take on civilization building. Of course, microgames and TARDIS games represent just one end of the tabletop spectrum. Tabletop games were also getting bigger and more elaborate than ever before, with ambition and production values beyond anything that had been available up to that point. Games like these had an audience, players who loved their bling and who were willing to pay up front for it. Sometimes these mega games lived up to their hype, and sometimes they didn't. Our next game changer more than lived up to it, for better, and, as we shall see, for worse. That was part 2 of episode 10 of The Game Changers. I'm David Weiss for the Daily Worker Placement. Thanks for listening. See you next time, and don't flip that table.